Hi, and welcome to episode 102 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where small press comics make one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mouse from Mars, and joining me, as always, are the creator of the superhero webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
The Garibaldi in our biscuit barrel, Tony Esmond.
Hello.
I bet you love a Garibaldi, don't you, Tony?
I do like Garibaldi's, yeah. I don't know what my favourite biscuit is. I'll think about it and announce it at the end of the show.
Oh, I know what my favourite biscuit is, so we'll get into that later.
Okay, nice.
The other week said to me that I eat Garibaldi's every day, and I can't think of a worse insult than that.
That is pretty harsh.
I was like, fuck you.
Let's kill him, Dan.
Yeah, that's fucking beyond the pale. It's unbelievable.
We know how to push Dan Butcher's buttons from now on. Yes, and this week we're joined by the writer of the critically acclaimed Beast Wagon, Raygun Rhodes, and whose new project, Real Love, is currently doing the rounds on the crowdfunding site Unbound, and we've been lucky enough to have a look at it. It's Mr. Owen Michael Johnson. Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. Hello. The audience is all saying hello as we speak. Thank you very much for joining us. I believe the last time we spoke was at the 2000 AD event.
It was, yeah.
Ah.
Yes, when...
I was... Get a bottle of gin in your pocket or something, I think you said.
I can't believe that I was doing that while I was working, guys. but at that point, I was pretty much dead on my feet, I believe.
Yeah.
It was a long day, but a great day.
I can imagine it was a long day.
We all rode victorious on the Fury Road that day.
Yes. you can't tell he's a writer, can you? Bloody hell! Yeah. It was already starting.
Yeah, coming out with shy.
Oh dear. So we're going to be talking about comic writing this week, but before we do, this episode of the Awesome Comics Pod is brought to you, as always, with the help from the fine people of Comic House. They've got a Kickstarter at the moment, so head on over to it and search for Comic House and check out the campaign for their awesome looking streaming comics app. It's only got a couple of days left and it ends on the 15th of June, I believe, so get in now on the ground floor. Now, our loyal listeners will probably have already headed over there by now, but if you're new to the show, here's what it's about. it's a comics app, basically. The campaign is to help fund a comic subscription app that will not only allow comics fans all over the world to discover comics and actively support the independent creators behind them, but they'll have a whole library of stuff that they can check out. If you listen to this show, you probably like checking out stuff that you like, discovering comics. That's why we're all here, isn't it, really? So, yeah. And as the page tells it, it's like Netflix, but for indie comics. So even an idiot could understand that. And so you'd have to be an equal idiot to miss out on the idea. So for a monthly subscription fee of just £3, you get access to the entire library of comics that Comic House has. £3, you can't buy a comic for that price these days. Well, most of the time you can't, I wouldn't imagine. And even one normal one is probably filled with ads and is about probably 15 pages long.
Hostess fruit pies.
You love a fruit pie.
I do.
There's going to be a huge digital library at your fingertips, and it will only grow and grow. So if that sounds like something you think sounds cool, and I know some of our listeners have already said that it does, then the Kickstarter gives you all the information you need, because my waffle doesn't do it justice. They lay it all out, what the app will be, what you'll get, and more. It's well worth your time, and if you love the indie scene like we do, it's well worth signing up for.
Yeah,
so there you go.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you to them, as always. Yeah, good lads as well, the people of Comic House.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy, isn't he? And very sort of communicative with us and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very pleased that we're doing this, so that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
Now, as we've got Owen on the show, we thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about some process talk. We know a lot of you out there love a bit of that, don't you? You love a bit of process. I've made it sound dirty already, haven't I?
Yes.
And this week is all about writing for comics. We all love the artwork and we talk about the artwork, but you know, normally there's got to be some decent words behind it. So, you know,
There's some words. I don't know about
some words. Yeah. It doesn't need words, but there has to be someone who's actually written it originally.
You know, kind of through the years in comics, we've kind of gone through this swing where we swung one side like everyone's focusing on the writer, and then it go to the other side, everyone's focusing on the artist.
Yeah.
Where do you think we are now?
If you listen to the internet, it seems they think it's the writer at the moment, less than the artist.
Yeah. I think it's a bit more balanced. Certainly at the start, maybe about 10, 12 years ago, it was very much writer driven, you know, with Bendis and Brubaker and Fraction, all this sort of thing. But I think it's swinging a little bit more to the middle now. I'd say it's a little bit more equal, I'm going to say. But yeah, it's still a lot of big name writers out there, aren't there? You know?
Yeah. I mean, certainly I would think if you're talking about your big two, it's more the writers who are the bigger names than a lot of the artists, I would say. And these are big name artists, of course, but
you know, yeah,
it's the writers' names that get bandied about, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, who are the superstar artists at the moment, would you say? You know, it's funny, isn't it?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. Like, Humberto Ramos will always be a superstar artist, like for all time, but I think because he's such a constant, he doesn't...
Yeah, people would sort of take him for granted, don't they?
Yeah.
A bit like somebody like Bagley and, you know, these sort of guys. It's sort of, Immerman. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think...
We were talking about London Super Comic Con before we came on air, weren't we? The two people we both said, I'm looking forward to see was Bendis and Slott, both writers, you know.
Yeah.
Interesting, isn't it? They're the two names that immediately sprang to mind when we were talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dan did bring up Jay Lee first, though.
Oh, yeah, he did mention Jay Lee, didn't he? Yeah, we're excited to see him, aren't we?
Never mind about all those artists, though. Who needs them? Well, actually, no, don't send me any hate mail.
What called them earlier? Art monkeys? Is that what you call them? We just put them in a cage and feed them food?
That would be to suggest that they are living life forms that deserve respect. But, please, God, be gentle with me, people.
His phone number is 07489.
Uh-oh.
It's already begun. No. Now, we're going to be talking about writing, as we said. We've had some nice little questions fed through the social media vine, which we'll get into a bit later. But before that, to kick us all off, let's start with this. Gentlemen, when you sit down to write your latest opus... yes, opus. See, I write too. Are there any particular things you have to hand? Now, Tony, calm yourself. What I mean is... Do you have, like, notebooks, sketch pads, a lucky rabbit's foot? Well, what are the things that you wouldn't be without when you actually write?
Is this to the group, or is this...
Yeah, you start, Owen. Yeah.
All right. Not particularly, beyond, like, a notebook, I guess. That's kind of the only thing. I do have... I wouldn't call it a lucky rabbit's foot. I have a crocodile's foot on my keys that John Pearson, who's the artist on Beastwagon, brought me back from New Orleans. But I wouldn't say that's a lucky thing. That's just an animal's foot.
What is the
just
size
coincidental
of this?
Animal's foot, yeah.
I'm guessing it's a small crocodile.
You got big pockets.
Yeah.
No, it's like about the size of a small dog.
Oh, that's cool.
You have to wear a backpack to accommodate it. Small.
Yeah.
No one will ever steal your keys, though, will they? Let's face it.
No. Yeah.
That's good.
But when it comes to your notebook, is it like a big thick notebook that has just got millions and millions of ideas of different stories, or do you have a specific notebook for the story that you're telling?
Definitely one per story, and they kind of they decide what they're going to be, if that makes any sense. So I have a pile of notebooks that you get from relatives or you pick up or anything like that, and they always, I find, decide what stories that they want in them, but they're always project specific, which is kind of a pain in the ass if you're working on maybe three or four at the same time, because you've got to cart them around with you. But I find that, you know, my OCD really kicks off if I don't have that specific story in that specific notebook.
I know what you mean. We do. I think a lot of the time we do sort of fetishize, if that's a word, notebooks, don't we? I've got an addiction to stationery. I think if I see a nice notebook,
you're not alone. Yeah. You're not alone.
I have to say, I keep it all in one, but it's just because I spend my life on the go. So most of my writing is done in coffee shops and on a train and stuff. So I generally keep it, but I am like really OCD about keeping it neat and stuff. And you know, I never write phone numbers down or anything like that in it. I'll always find a bit of paper for that. I never write notes from work. I have a separate work one, and it just has. And there's a little pile of them sits next to where I record here as I've gone through. And Yeah, I'm quite sort of, I really pick and choose which notebooks I use. You know, they've got to be a soft cover. I don't like a plain white page in them. I like a lined page. You know, it's terrible, really. I think
lined page. I can't.
That's me too. Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just a sketchbook. I've got plain paper for sketch.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. And I talk
both stronger men than myself. I must have chaos. I must have chaos. In my notebook, it has to be just a dumping ground for my utter brain sewage. You know, everything, there can be no order. It has to be complete nonsense. Phone numbers, shopping lists, along with the deepest, darkest things one can conjure, must go in. Yeah. And haphazardly, you know, text that curves around, scribbles, absolutely everything.
Yeah, mine's full of like arrows that point to things. And I go back to it later and I think, what the fuck does that mean?
Yeah. I work completely differently. Not on. Right. I email stuff to myself all the time.
Right.
And then just have it on Word docs. Because the organization of like having the notebooks, there's so much stuff I carry around with me that I kind of like keep checking anyway. That having like carrying a notebook around and just thinking, right, that's all my eggs in one basket, would fucking freak me out. I would not like it. I think I'd lose that notebook. It's like fucking set fire to.
Yeah, that's true.
All your ideas.
The other thing I get as well is I do like drawing speed cocks on things. You know, one of my favourite things at work is when people get like a big pile of business cards in. I'll pull one of the ones out the middle, draw a speed cock on it, and put it back in.
That's
And it does bite, you know, you reap what you sow, don't you? Do you know what I mean? And I do open a notebook and someone's drawn a big speed cock on it and written, "This is Tony, ha ha," or something next to it. And I actually have to sort of physically cut those pages out because I do like a joke, but I don't want them in my notebook. Do you know what I mean?
No, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine no one wants them on their business cards either, but beggars can't be choosers.
Yeah. Yeah. Revenge is sweet.
Yeah. Quite.
But it is funny when you turn up to some sort of big meeting and someone opens their big notebook and there's a big picture of a speed cock I've drawn in great detail, you know, with a little face on it and everything. Yeah.
How can you draw a speed cock in great detail?
Well, you know, I suppose it's technically it's a speed one, but then I go back and add detail, you know.
Oh, I see, shading and,
I think
so. You really bring it to life.
Give it a little tattoo. Give it a personality. Write a name on it. Write a name on each of the balls. I think that's good as well.
I feel like if anything's over half an hour, it can't be deemed a speed cock.
Yeah, I think you're right.
If half
an hour would be good, wouldn't it? That would be like a piece of art, I think, wouldn't it?
Yeah. God, yeah. Maybe like photorealistic.
Have you ever worked on a penis that you've drawn for over a few months, maybe?
Interesting.
I feel like depending on how much effort you're putting in there, that
well, you'd need a separate notebook.
It's taken a lot of you. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that would use coloured pens and everything. I occasionally draw round one. Do you know what I mean? Nearly always mine, to be fair. Yeah.
We had a tutor back in university who was a right knob. And so I got really fucked off with him one time, went into the toilets with a marker and then drew a picture of him. It was quite a good picture. Massive. It must have been about 3 foot by 3 foot of him, like, sucking on a big cock. And one of the other tutors like were giving a lecture and said, "Oh, have you seen the graffiti over there? It's very good." And it took the janitor a week to keep painting over it because it kept on showing through.
I believe the statute of limitations has run out on that. Yeah.
That's my greatest achievement in university.
Every week.
All those resources wasted on doing that.
Where'd you get those pens from? Yeah. Every week you're my hero, Dan. Literally, it's happened again.
oh dear. Anyway, so notebook. So I knew you wouldn't have like a physical notebook, Dan. For some reason, I just knew you'd be all digital.
You have told us about you email yourself. Mm. You write notes, phone, and email an awful lot, don't you? Yeah.
It's not so much by choice. This is the fact that I can keep the thoughts a bit more organised because I don't know about you guys. Say you kind of like, right, I'm going to work on this story, and you get an idea about the beginning bit of the story, and then a bit about the end, and then you get another idea about the beginning. Does that just all come in? The ideas go in the notebook as they come in, or do you have it divided up?
Yeah, I'm worried. Well, I don't know. It's about you, Aim, but I get worried that I'll forget stuff sometimes, so I have to write it down straight away. Do you get that at all, or?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much, that's why I think it's good to just have a small or a light notebook. It's just that you just get any old crap in there as soon as it comes to you. And for me, it's really that notebook then, that's why I'll do it there, and then I'll transfer all of that to the computer, because that's basically my Petri dish for just putting any old shit in there, and then I can organize it, you know. But it's any idea gets put in there, and you know, you're before that stage where you kind of go, oh, that shit. You just have to literally just get everything in there. It's lots of it doesn't. It's a filtering system as well, I think, as much as it is a way of getting things down.
Someone gave me, I would say, the worst advice ever was that you should try and remember the ideas, and if you don't remember it, I mean, the idea was not of any worth.
I think that's absolute horseshit.
I'm not a big fan of that idea. Yeah, no. we just forget stuff, don't we? Because the world is confusing. Yeah.
Well, you forget stuff, and I think the first step in actually being a practicing writer is actually justifying to yourself your ideas, whereas 90% of the public will go, "Ah, that's a stupid idea," and then we'll forget it. You know, I feel like 90% of things is not filtering your ideas or saying what is good or what is bad or whether you remember stuff. Certainly, as you get older, you forget stuff all the time. But it's the idea of just keeping track of absolutely everything, regardless of whether you think you'll forget it or not.
It's ridiculous. Ridiculous advice.
Because it could always, even the really terrible stuff or the minute stuff that you will probably end up forgetting is the germ of something that is going to be very important. You just need to spend time with that thing written down and thinking about it so it becomes something bigger, you know?
Yeah, and an idea isn't always like a big idea for a big thing, you know. Like, you know, aliens versus something or other. It's little bits, isn't it? It's like what he's going to say or a line of dialogue, something like that. I was listening to an interview with Danny Baker today on the radio, and apart from blowing himself, which I never heard anyone talk about themselves so well ever, he did actually say, he said, you write a line, just a phrase, and you'll think you're the champion of the world just because of that phrase. You know, and sometimes as you write stuff, you know, or think about stuff, it does occur to you, and you just really want to get that phrase down, don't you?
Yeah.
You know.
And then sometimes you look back and you've really honed on something, and you realize it's still shite, so that's fine too.
You know? Sometimes you spend years on it.
But, you know, you just got to keep polishing those turds, and sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't. So
brutal bit with comics, obviously, is that as opposed to kind of a book, we've got a lot more kind of like you can pack a lot more in per page. The comic, I find, you have to be so much brutal in what you're cutting away. And a lot of the time I feel like you cut away good stuff, but it just cannot justify the 20, 30 page comic or whatever the size of the comic you're writing. And it's like that it doesn't move the story fast enough, so it's got to go.
And, absolutely.
That's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like in many ways writing comics is closer to film. Or specifically animation, in that, you know, there's that whole thing of if with animation, in that if you notice it's animation and you're not getting pulled along in the story, then it's crap, and you really want to just it has to look effortless, and that's kind of how I feel about comics, or certainly like in sort of screenplay or film, is that you're trying to distill everything. Your structure, your plot, your characters, you're doing so much pre-work before you even, I feel, good comics anyway, do so much conceptual work before you actually definitely. Just get down to what people are seeing, that there's a mountain of stuff that's gone on behind the scenes, whereas the process, I think, of a novel is more like, you know, all you have are the words to basically create the rhythms, create everything that you need. But a lot of the time, I find prose writers are basically, that's why they end up redrafting stuff to get it right, is that most of their process is actually on the page. Whereas with visual media, most of your process is in planning everything.
You know? And certainly you have to plan it and get the script really up to point, especially if you're working with an artist, because then it moves beyond, you know, I mean, for instance, for Dan and myself, we've written scripts for ourselves, haven't we, Dan? And then we go and draw it, but it's a completely different process I find when I'm writing a script that I'm possibly going to give to someone else.
Yeah.
Because then they need to, you know, everyone has a different way of writing scripts, but you've still got to get across what's happening in the scenes, you know, just the right detail for the artist to give you the best possible page.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like as well, what people maybe don't realize that maybe outside the industry or you know, just comics generally realize that in many ways creators are as subjective about their process and what they really want from comics as you would be in any other medium. So there's some comics out there that I think are absolute trash. I'm not naming names, you know. Then the other way kind of is the same, and I'll love something that someone else is, you know, doesn't think is that great. Some people look for plot, like you said, you know, earlier, like people want really great writing, some people want great art. What you kind of bring to it is totally different.
So have you done a project where you've written but you didn't know who would get it to draw?
I rarely do that because I at this point I am only really working with people that I know I really want to work with. I'm not really going in because I draw for myself as well. If there's any project that I want and I have a specific way that I want to see realized, I'll either draw it for myself or I'll work with someone who I trust. I don't really, you know, generate projects without having an artist in mind, because for me, it may be anathema to other people, but for me, I don't. The visuals and an artist on the project is so integral. It's 90% of the medium we're working in. So if you don't know what the story is and what artist you're using for that story, I don't really see how you can run it.
Yeah, of course it does. Yeah, do you meet a guy or a girl in there, an artist, and you think, oh, that's really, I like your style, and then the idea comes up? Or is there something that's sort of creeping about in the back of your brain? You think, well, I've got this idea for a sort of thing about this. What do you think about that? How does it, or so far, how has it done? How has it grown with you? You know?
So far, yeah, it's been very much, I've known people through either knowing the small press scene in the UK, or through the internet or things like that. And now it's kind of, it's changing because I'm in a transition period where I think I'm just doing more stuff beyond the few projects I have that I know are kind of in the works. Most of the stuff I'm going to do from now on is basically going to be me writing and drawing it. So I just have kind of vision control over that. But
Okay. Generally,
like with Raygun, that was very much, I was working on Accent UK short stories and things like that. And I saw Indio's work and was like, this guy's absolutely amazing. I'm just going to give him a shout and see if he wants to work on something.
Cool.
And it was very much, I'm writing this for that guy. And most of the stuff I've done has been like, oh, you're really good. I've worked with you on a short thing. Do you want to do a bigger thing? You know, and that kind of thing. And also just hanging out with people at shows, you know, most of the people have been making friends with them and realizing that they're really good and wanting to work together. But some people, you know, I believe you guys had a chat with Jay Gunn.
Yes.
A while back.
Yes, good lad.
Lovely guy. Love him to pieces. But when I was over working at Titan, I was working on the marketing for Surface Tension. And just started chatting with him basically just from doing signings with him or like really liking him as a person and liking his work. And we've talked and become friends about doing a book together, but it's never happened just because we've both been busy doing other things. So there's people you know you want to work with, but it may be years down the line.
Haven't you just been on holiday with him?
we didn't plan it. It wasn't like a, you know,
we didn't go camping together or anything like
that. Harold and Maud kind of thing. But we both knew we were going to be in Tokyo at the same time. So he just met up for a beer and he showed me around, because he's been out there a lot more than I have. He showed me around all of the weird otaku stores where, you can get like, you know, those dispenser machines where you can get like, you know, balls filled with used panties and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, did you get me some?
Yeah. There's like there's a shipment coming over for you. So.
That can tell.
So that was super cool. But yeah, we didn't plan it.
Okay.
We just knew we were out in the same time. But yeah, he's a guy that you know I'd love to work with, but it's just the right time, you know. Yeah.
But haven't you ever got an idea, Owen, and you sort of jotted it down, and then you thought, oh, I wonder who'd be good for that, and then have you reached out to anyone? You know, and you thought, oh, maybe they would do it and they don't, or you've looked for someone else, you know, nothing like that ever happened, or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's been projects that I actually have some projects in the works right now that were with a different artist, but they said, well, I can't do it for scheduling reasons, or we kind of started working on it and was like, well, this isn't right just now. That's happened with loads of stuff. And equally,
there's a lot of busy people out there, aren't there? Let's face it.
Being an artist is
a busy occupation, isn't it? You know,
it's harder, certainly, than being a writer, you know.
Yeah.
Basically, we're nothing without them.
Let's put it out there. You're right,
Yeah. I mean, and also their time is just, it takes a lot longer and it's a lot more effort to sit and draw, which is why you see a lot of people becoming kind of writer artists, because it's absolutely, they feel like if it, and I'm kind of coming to a similar realization with some of my writing stuff. It's like, when it takes that long,
you
kind of are like, well, I might as well do my own thing, you know. And that's not to say that every single artist that wants to be a writer as well is good enough to do that, because they're two very, very different disciplines.
Yeah.
But it's a lot harder for writers to then go, okay, I'll draw my own books, because it's really hard to draw a book really, really well.
Yeah. So, but you, Vince, you and Dan recently have drawn stuff for other people, haven't you?
Yeah.
How do you find that when someone comes to you with a script? Is it very much right, open page one, start drawing, or is it a bit of sort of to and fro, or a bit of contact, or do you have to sort of design, you know, talk about designs and all that sort of thing?
There is all of that, yeah. I kind of
yeah.
I have to read the script through a couple of times, and then I'll thumbnail it. And when I start doing thumbnails of how I think pages will look like, that's when I usually spot mistakes or errors, like, well, how can he be here if he was there like 5 minutes ago? Stuff like that. And then they're like, oh shit, yeah, I didn't see that. But yeah, like with the designs and stuff, I usually ask the writer, right, what are you looking for? Kind of, what does this look like? And maybe they send over some reference. The more direction, the better. But then sometimes you come up with stuff and the writer's like, that's great. I didn't think of the character looking like that, but I really like it. And
I mean, with me, when I'm writing a scene, in every panel, I write who is going to be in it. I know not all writers do that, because I think someone says, oh, same view as last, you know, the last panel, you know, this character now saying this. I always put such John and Mandy and George are all in this panel still.
Yeah.
And I always include that, because I think sometimes you kind of forget that things move about, don't they, you know?
Yeah. If you do that and an artist brings the panel back and it doesn't necessarily have those characters exactly, do you tell them to amend it, or if it works, is it fine as is?
I think it's very much suck it and see. It depends on the story, I think. A lot of times it will work, you know, or they'll even add a character sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
But the continuity thing is, I find, is the thing that a lot of artists will say. They'll say, how you know, how long after this is this, and you know, how far have they gone, and what's the plan, where will they be leaving after this? For example, if you write a scene in a warehouse and then your character escapes, you're going to want to know how they escape. Is it up a staircase that they might have to draw in the picture in the previous issue? You know, it's all that sort of thing. So I tend to like, put quite a lot of detail in, you know.
Yeah, I feel like that's on the writer to get their shit together on continuity before kind of handing over a script. But yeah, this was just generally a question for the, you know, writer/artist. Are you firm in your scripting? For every single project, is that the same? Personally, every single project I do can be slightly different in terms of how I actually execute a script.
I certainly...
But do you guys have your own, like, template, this is what I do every single time, or...?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly when I'm doing the Red Mask, because I make small mock-ups, and then I write a script from that. And
oh, you thumbnail yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
And to see how it flows. Yeah. And I make like these little A6 sort of like comics in a way with very rough thumbnails, but I can see how the pages flow, you know, from the page turn, etc. And I write from that, but because I've got that visual reference and the script is just for myself, the panel descriptions will be quite basic because I already know what kind of is happening or what angles I want to do. Mm. But if I'm writing for someone else, or if I'm not doing something, you know, I'm not doing the art, I'm a lot more descriptive with, not necessarily the angles, because I like to think of, you know, if you've got an artist on board and you're excited about working with them, there's a,
yep.
I just want to let the artist go for it. Just, you know, I want to tell them what happens in this panel, who's going to be there, you know, the action that's going to, the important things that are going to happen. But in terms of camera angles, you know, etc., that can be whatever.
You don't deliver those thumbnails. Sorry.
It's okay, no, go on, mate. Yeah, go on.
You don't deliver those thumbnails to the artist if you're writing for another artist?
I probably wouldn't, unless I have a super specific idea of how a page is going to be. You know, and I say, oh, you know, when I thought of this, this is how I imagined it. But go for your life. Other than that, it's like just let the artist do their best work, kind of thing. You know, just
yeah. I think it's very job specific, isn't it? Yeah. I'm not a draw. You know, I can't really draw very well. But I thumbnailed out for a job last year because the artist said, "Look, would you mind? I've not done that much sequential. Would you mind thumbnailing it?" So I did. Mm. And then recently, I did a script for Dave Brown. Actually, Dave and I are doing a little project together. And there's one specific page. I had a real sort of vision of how I wanted it to be. So I thumbnailed it out, and it's quite difficult to describe sometimes images in words, isn't it? Sometimes you do need that little extra edge of how you want, especially if it's sort of quite a sort of trippy dream sequence type page. So I drew how I saw it. I've got no problem whatsoever with Dave changing it, because I know Dave's very capable, but just to get across what I was trying to communicate in words, I drew a little, you know, and then I cut and pasted that into a Word document and sent him that as well, you know. Sometimes that can help.
I think it's
communication, isn't it, at the end of the day, you know.
Definitely, it's when you're the writer, you've got to kind of play to the strengths of the artist, and if they know what they're doing, giving them the kind of the script, you handle the writing side, let them handle the art side of it. Do you know what I mean? If you're trying to kind of overburden them with instructions, I think it's to the detriment of the project.
Yeah, 100% agree on that one. And feel that if you're getting this artist on board, you're getting them on board for that specific project.
Exactly.
And that you know that they know what the fuck they're doing. Yeah. And that's not to say that the process doesn't alter or tweak. For example,
that's a big thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Indio on Reagan is very much like he's a loose cannon, and I write I wrote for him Marvel style because that was the best way that he worked. You know, it would be pretty Kerouac all over the whole thing. I'd just sit down and be like, and there's this, and there's this, and he's confident breaking it up in a way because he's got so much energy to his stuff. You don't want to dictate panel arrangements to that guy because it's just not going to be as much fun unless you let him cut loose. Whereas with B-Swag, you know, John, it was his first kind of sequential book. He was incredibly good tonally. You don't want to kind of put any, you don't want to strong arm him into anything on how the colors are looking or anything like that, because he can handle the crap out of that. It's just you need to know that beat by beat, panel by panel, your structure is tight. And then when you deliver that to him, that's something that he can then, you know what I mean? So you've got to know what people, and that's just a conversational thing. I'm sure you guys have conversations when you get cracking with artists where you just say, what kind of the stuff do you really like? What do you know?
Oh, and
it's also really important, I think, to read artists' work that they've done before maybe they work with you. What are they really, and really recognize, what are they really good at?
Yeah.
How do I use that to my advantage? What do they kind of suck at in the nicest possible way? How do I either stretch them in the right way and put them out of their comfort zone a little bit without basically divorcing them from why they're really great at what they do?
Yeah, definitely. I think you've got to negotiate a change sometimes with an artist who comes on board. I'm doing, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, doing this book with Nick Prolix, and he has got such a specific style that I've sort of catered a little bit for that in some of the later chapters I'm writing. Mm. Because I know how good he is, and I know he will do it in a specific way. So it's changed the slight the way at this, especially in relation to the number of panels he can manage on a page. A lot of artists just, you know, they don't want to cram in those talking heads, and you know they won't be as interesting with him. His, you know, even his talking heads are like, you know, really funny, you know, really interesting. Mm. where some other artists perhaps would have been a bit more banal, you know?
Yeah.
You really got to cater it to the artist.
Yeah. So when you write scripts for yourself, then, Owen, how detailed are your specific scripts if you want to do the art for a project?
They're really, really not detailed at all. In fact, I've only really just started doing scripts for myself.
Right.
Really. I mean, I do script everything just like I would for someone else, but it's very much blah, blah looks out the window, or like it's the most, you know, so bare. But my notebook stage for working on my own stuff is far vaster. So, well, as a caveat, things are changing right now because Real Love got picked up by Unbound. So I have to be in a position where I'm basically delivering script at a level that I would be for an artist, if that makes sense.
Right, okay.
Because you're justifying...
Someone's going to have to read it, aren't they? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're justifying to the publisher that you made the right storytelling choices.
Okay.
Whereas if I was still self-publishing myself, I would just trust my own process. But to be fair, I'm working with an editor who understands how I work, so that's a lot better than basically having to spell out all of the bells and whistles for someone. But it's more like a jazz, if you'll forgive the kind of wanky expression on that. It's more that I'll kind of know where the whole thing's going, and I'll just improvise it a little bit more than, because at this point I kind of trust that I know the story arc and I know all the characters and everything like that. I'll do an outline, I'll still script it, but there could be a wild difference between what I'm scripting and what actually ends up on the page, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm.
But yeah, it's the notebook stage is kind of like, as I'm writing script, I'm doing full thumbnails for myself, and I know where the whole thing is going. But for me as well, because I don't work traditionally, I don't work digitally at all, like a lot of artists are now doing. I'm pretty much evangelical, because I just don't understand what the hell I'm doing. I'm still traditional, like all I have is ink and brush and paper,
but that's what gives your work a real nice style, though. You can see the brush work on the page, you know.
That scratch sometimes, don't we? Want that approach to it, don't we? It doesn't always have to be super rounded off, I think, you know.
I mean, you also have that risk factor of, like, if you drop some ink on that fucker, then you are toast. You know, like, your ass is on the line when you're kind of working in, you know, in core time. So it allows for those mistakes, but that's the kind of stuff I like. You know, I like that the Jeff Lemire kind of stuff. I like rawer, you know,
for your
storytelling. Game. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love texture. Like, I'm really into, like, James Harren and the way he uses ink on his stuff. And Sean Murphy, obviously, is a huge influence on my stuff. So I like that textured approach that you can only really get through doing stuff traditionally. But
I think
I'm sidetracking off your point now, so I apologize for the rambles there.
With the art, definitely people seem to appreciate the kind of traditional stuff because they can see the workings, whereas the digital, the workings is there, but it's so clean that there seems to be a disconnect, thinking that there is that work there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I fucking love some digital stuff. There's Mark Penman. I don't know if you guys know his stuff. Oh, he's from Manchester. Yeah, like Waterbringer, if we're doing like name drop stuff, which I know is your section later on, but he did a book called The Waterbringer, which is part of his Cimmerian Tales.
Yeah.
Amazing. He's all digital, and he still has that energy that you're like, fuck, this is really, really raw.
Yeah.
But there's some stuff out there that I feel like you literally, no matter what kind of textured brushes you're using digitally, you cannot fake the risk of basically fucking up your work every time you do a page. Yeah. And I feel like a lot of that you can feel when I'm reading stuff and it's digital and it's like textured brushes. It still has that level of, I can feel this isn't quite right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to Mark Lambeau about this, Mark Lemming, the other day, and he was saying, and I make him right on this, he was saying the energy for a piece lays in the thumbnails, because that is where the real energy and the flow of it comes from, you know, and I love seeing that stuff as well. You know, if you get a trade and it's got some thumbnails in the back, I love seeing that, because that's what really shows the art for me.
100%. You know? Like, the story literally is make or break on thumbnails. Yeah. And I've had things that I've been like, well, this page looks really, really great, and I've kind of fudged it once it's got to actual, but
right.
But only I noticed that. Does that make sense? Like, it flows in a way that it's like, that's a strong page. But I've had pages that do not work in thumbnail, and it doesn't matter how good your art is on those pages, it's still fucked. You know, like you'll never ever fix if you get a shitty thumbnail. You know.
To be fair, my weakest stuff is where I've got the script for the page, and I've not been able to do the thumbnail for it. It's usually a dialogue heavy one, so like I'll put the page together as I go along digitally, and it's very stilted and it doesn't flow nicely for me, at least. Maybe the readers don't know any different, but I always feel like the ones where I don't have a solid plan going into the page, they're the ones that end up the worst. But I know a lot of pros like do thumbnails, then blow them up, and then draw over the top of that to keep that kind of that energy.
With digital now, that's happening a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. I think I'd say that page this week, mate, was brilliant. I know you said to me you'd done it last minute, but the energy on that page.
Oh, thank you.
I love that page. There's a real sort of. With one character running, you know, it's a real sort of powerful piece. Very good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. No, pleasure, mate. Good. So have you guys ever, as writers, have you ever got a page back and gone, oh, I don't like it? Have you ever done that, and how do you broach it to say that you don't?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I can't speak so much to this because I haven't really worked, you know, I've got a few scripts in the pipeline, but I haven't really had anything sort of progress to that stage yet.
Yeah. What about you, Owen?
I'm trying to actually think. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Because I've known going in that I've been so in love with everybody I've worked with. Mm. If that makes any sense. It sounds really stupid to say, because obviously I'm not in love with everybody I work with. But I feel like it's such a good. It's a good part of the process when you do get stuff back that you don't. It's always been surprising. But not like bad, because I know I'm kind of going in with people who really have that quality that I'm after. I have tweaked and changed loads of things I've written after seeing stuff back. I think that's
especially you guys would all agree.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a part of the process. You should always get kind of a lettering draft to before it goes maybe to a letterer to go, well, I need to tweak this now that I've seen all the artwork, stuff like that. That just makes for a more organic reading experience. But there's nothing that I've said, no, redraw that, because I feel like that's kind of a shitty move, personally. Okay. I mean.
One thing, if like the writers put a scene, a panel, and the artist interprets it, the character's feeling one emotion where perhaps the artist thought there was another going on, and that's a good time to tweak it just to reflect what's going on. To say he was quite ambiguous about what the character was talking about, like, oh, we've got to go to the shops or something, and the artist done it like them looking a bit pensive, and you actually wanted it to be quite cheery, you would have to tweak that dialogue maybe to reflect what the artist has done.
Tweaked, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like if an artist delivering something that is literally the polar opposite of the emotion you're trying to convey, then you've got maybe a communication problem there.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd like to avoid those. But I don't know if you guys do this generally, but I'll always, if it's possible, after I've given over a script before the artist's even started working on it, we'll have a giant conversation via the phone, or if we can meet up, we'll do that. We go through, if they're happy to, and we'll literally, hopefully not be talking at them, but basically have a dialogue about the entire thing start to finish. So no one knows scene to scene, page to page, panel to panel. We did that all the way through Beast Wagon, where everybody knows exactly what the emotion and the atmosphere and what you want to try and be expressed is. You could put that in a script, but no artist, I believe, wants a fucking Alan Moore doorstop.
No, I think you're right. Yeah.
No, yeah.
You know, even Kevin O'Neill and Dave Gibbons would go in, read it once, and just highlight the bits they need to know. You know, so they only ever read it, if they're lucky, once, you know, and the rest is, on an Alan Moore script, that is, the rest is sort of highlighted, the bits they need to bother with. You know.
But I also know that, like, that is a really, and I do still, with some people, really, really want to go into detail. Like, Alan's way of writing stuff like revolutionized everything. in that you were getting stuff that was thought about on a level that no one else was doing at the time in terms of how you thought about the visuals of comics and how everything links up together. And that's still an approach that I think really
as a reader, I love reading his scripts. I have to say, as a sort of fan of his, I love reading them. But I can imagine getting a phone directory through the post and going, right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it helps that he actually does do that call as well before he gets cracking, so that at least you know as an artist, you're receiving, it may be a doorstop that's going to take you a while, but you know that he's built in everything you want to draw.
Yeah, I feel...
That must be very special.
Yeah. I mean, I feel for him a bit because as only a writer, I hand scripts over and I do feel a little bit like I'm handing over my baby. You know, there is a little bit of like, you know, please treat my baby well, you know, and then sometimes, and well, sometimes brilliantly and sometimes not so brilliantly, I'll get the art back and I think, fucking hell, that looks great. I didn't expect that. And it's suddenly a different creature.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Suddenly it's a different, whole different thing. Yeah. You know?
Well, I kind of think of it like you hand over your baby that has been kind of with you for a while. And then it kind of gets dropped off to you with like clothes on that are way cooler than the clothes that you gave it. And you're like, wow, excellent, you know. That's kind of how I feel it should be anyway. You kind of you trust someone to style it in the way that, you know,
nothing's gonna come out exactly as it's in your brain, is it? Let's face it, nothing is gonna come out like, you know.
Sometimes it can do, but I feel like generally the best way of working in comics is basically that beautiful alchemy where you're creating something that is so much better than either of you could have done separately. And that goes for like the whole creative team, you know, like if you've got a letterer that is basically going to be a third storyteller, that is going to bring ideas to how things are done that is way above everything else. A colorist that's going to kind of come in with a palette and go, well, you were thinking about this, but look how bonkers this looks. I love those kind of, the alchemy that you can create with everybody involved at the same time when everyone's like firing on all cylinders, that it's just magic.
Yeah, don't give letterers too much credit.
I was going to make talk about the my recommend later on, but kind of for me, a good letterer is like a good sound engineer in a film. They're, when they do their job well, it adds to it and they're not noticed too much. But when it's bad, it really sticks out like a sore thumb and can kind of ruin the experience.
Yeah, you're definitely right there, mate. The other thing I was we've been talking about it, we're doing a bit of an anthology, Owen, and we've been talking about, I know I've started, I literally live in the Iron Age. I don't have a clue what a computer is or how it works. You know what I mean?
We're on a computer now.
Chiseling directly on the tablet.
Yeah, I'm speaking into your brain. I don't understand how, you know, I wouldn't know how to turn one on most of the time. But I've started using something called Trello, which Nick introduced me to. And it's kind of, you described it best, didn't you, Dan, as like a workflow program.
Yes.
And we live in this sort of brilliant age now where he posts a page, he posts the pencils, I comment on it, you know, I change the dialogue. And it's all done on this program. It's really good. Mm. I have to say, do you have a specific way you work with ISO? And do you want to see each page as it's done or... Do you okay?
I haven't checked that out, that program, but generally Google Docs. I'm working on something right now that is like I'm kind of writing it, but it's plotted with someone else, and that person does the thumbnails, but there's a separate artist that's basically taking the thumbnails and doing full art off the back of that, and that's very much like more of a music kind of thing that everybody has a say and it kind of comes together in it. But so Google Docs is great for that.
Yeah.
If it's just one person, I'll generally have a chat with them and then just give them a script. You know, I feel like I'd like to get to a point, again, it's just going to sound really wanky, where I'd like to deliver scripts like by post or something like that, because
and walk away.
Just leave it there for someone else to clean up a mess. But generally, I feel like sometimes, this is talking from experience, I feel like if something exists in sort of a Google Doc where you can endlessly edit it, I will just George Lucas the living shit out of that. And even when they're working on it, I find that there's a danger when you're kind of collaborating on comics, is that the power balance will be imprecise, or you'll deliver something and like
you guys said, or an artist will go, well, what about this? You haven't thought about this, and then as a writer, you'll kind of be like, shit, I didn't think about that before. Yeah. But there's that can lead to a lot of delays in a project, I feel, when you can endlessly edit stuff, and there's something very permanent about, and it forces as a writer to be in the position where you really have to like have worked all your shit out.
Yeah, yeah.
Before you give it over, and there's a finality to, okay, this is done now, and if I've messed it up, then you know that's on me. But an artist, I believe, should be getting the final version of something.
Right.
So that's why I feel like Google Docs is a tricky one, and I'll use it for some stuff, but generally I don't trust myself not to tinker.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. You
know what I mean? Yeah. There's a fine line there, isn't there, somewhere, I think, Owen, isn't there? Between I know exactly where you're coming from, Randy. And I think it very much depends on the artist you're working with. I mean, I'm currently, like, Nick and I talk 5 times a day, and I'm loving that negotiation and that conversation, you know,
it's
around
really special when you can do that.
Definitely.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think I'm actually running out of good things. You know, he sends me a page and I'm blown away by it. I'm actually having to think of different phrases to say because you can't keep saying that's really great, that's really cool. I'm
yeah,
you know what I mean? It's actually so good.
You need a running cycle of about 5. Start again.
That's the tits.
I'm using that tomorrow. You listen, Nick. Getting to that's the tits tomorrow. But it's genuinely that good. And I just feel like saying, you know, this is just, what was the one I said the other day? This is going to kick someone's teeth out. I love that one because that's how I felt about it, you know. But I love that collaboration, especially if it's with someone who is of a conversational level, put it that way. I mean, I've worked with foreign artists and stuff before, and you can't always go that way, you know?
No.
But yeah, this is great. I'm really enjoying it, you know.
Well, that's a nice little...
There must be something nice about that also, in that really you're communicating through the work. If maybe there's the language barrier and you can't really become too close friends with artists that are maybe on, I assume it's on the continent or further afield.
Yeah, but I mean, both cases are completely other continent. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a difficult one.
That's a nice segue for our first question, I think.
Oh.
Let's start. There's quite a few of these. But
may have answered quite a few as well.
I am editing as I go along, as I'm reading them, because I read them and then go, oh, we've already done that, so don't worry about that. Right, Mike West at Mike 333 West. He said, are you ever put off writing a book without an artist in mind or because of budget restrictions?
What do you mean by budget restrictions? I don't quite get that. Sorry.
As in page rate.
Yeah, page rate.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. What, you get paid for writing comics? Well, how did this start?
No.
No, so you're the writer and you've got to go, right, the artist I want charges £100 per page and I've written a 25-page comic. I can't afford.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we don't want him, do we?
We want the artist that works for exposure.
Yes, exactly. I'll put on that dress I made on the desert island last week. That'll count for £10.
Yeah.
To be fair, I've not been in the situation where I've hired an artist to do a whole comic. I've hired people to do pin-ups and little bits and bobs. Yeah. So I can't really, yeah.
But would you, with that in mind, Dan, would you go ahead and write a story and then find an artist afterwards if the story just, you know, you were desperate to get that story done? Or would you think, because you don't have an artist in mind, that would stop you from writing it?
I've got to say, I'm pretty brutal on ideas, because I can come up with, like all you guys being creatives, you can come up with ideas for new stories all the time, and most of the time I just absolutely squash them. So I can't start putting energy into a new idea or a new story that I know is not going to go anywhere, because it's kind of, I feel like it's wasting my time. I need to spend...
This is a bigger conversation just about the industry generally, in that there aren't enough publishers for the amount of work there is out there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's
readers.
There's not enough readers, and there's not enough kind of it's not, for a lot of people, it's not sustaining. A lot of creators are finding that they'll work for maybe 5 years, maybe longer, and then realize that the opportunities just aren't there for them. And that's why, in many ways, the industry can't grow sometimes in quite the way that it maybe needs to. That's why you'll find that all the passion projects are kind of done either by people who know each other, or they go on the internet or anything like that, or you know, those kind of things. It's certainly tricky right now, and you're seeing a constriction, I think, in the industry, or in the small press industry, because it's really hard to finance this stuff.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, it's a passion project, so even though you're paying for artists sometimes, you know you may not get the money back, and often you won't, you know. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, I definitely think that. To be fair, I write a lot of stuff that when I haven't got a clue who's going to be drawing it, just because I have a 2-hour commute every day and I enjoy writing.
Yeah.
And just the enjoyment of getting an idea down in paper and working it out. Sometimes, you know, this whole 10,000 goes at something before you become competent thing, I sometimes think is valid. And there's, you know, I've got 20 scripts sitting here that probably will never see the light of day. And I sent you guys one today that I just did it for fun, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's enjoy sorting stuff out. I suppose.
Certainly Cockney Kung Fu. I love saying that. That was something that you wrote a little while ago, and for fun, and you wanted to do it, and obviously we were lucky enough to see it. But you didn't have an artist in mind, but you had the story. You knew what you wanted to do with the story.
Yeah. And it sort of built up momentum, because I enjoyed writing it, I think, and it was a lot of sort of ideas. And I enjoyed chatting to you guys about it. And I held back from asking anyone until Nick came forward and said, "Can I see it?" And I thought, and I'm a big fan. We were all big fans of Nick's work before he took this up. And then he said, "I'd like to draw it." And I was over the moon, you know. But I think if he hadn't said that, I'd still be hanging on and waiting for that right person, really.
Yeah.
It's a bit like finding someone on Tinder, isn't it? You know,
you
sort of hang on until someone contacts you.
Wait for someone to swipe left.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know which.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Someone was saying to me there's like a super swipe or something you can do, a super like. Is that right?
Swipe.
Yeah, like you can sort of like, I really like this person.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I don't know anything about Tinder. I had to look up the swiping left and right business.
Yeah. We'll believe you, Dan.
But which direction does a super swipe?
If you go left, needs to know.
You swipe it up and down quickly till.
Wow. Just a lot until you, finish. Yeah.
Just keep swiping. That's it. Keep swiping.
So you just rub the touch screen then.
to be fair, we worked out a name for our letters page earlier, didn't we? Well, you did, Vince, didn't you?
No, I said something and you said we should use it as a letters page.
What did you say? I can't remember.
I can't remember now.
I can look it up on the WhatsApp.
Right. Let's get to another question. Oh, John Late at Level 8 Comics, he said, "Do you use contracts when you work with new artists?"
Oh, I put it out in an email. That's all I do. I haven't so far used a contract. I have signed a contract with people I've written for, but at the moment it's just an email saying, "Look, this is what I think we should do. If you agree, email me back." I don't think anything holds water legally. Has anyone ever been to small claims court about a small press person they didn't get on with? I don't expect they have they? Yeah. You know. So as long as you lay it out as an agreement is how I see it now. Yeah. You lay it out as an agreement, and if they decide not to do it, they decide not to do it, you know. Owen, what do you think?
It's very I think it's person by person, and I don't really like to get too much into that stuff, because it's very subjective, and it also depends what the reasons that you're in this for and everything like that. But I've always had an agreement with artists I'm working with, but Beast Wagon is the first one that actually went through to contract, because I feel like it's important to do that if it's just in writing, because you never know what's going to happen with something. But certainly, you know, there's different ways of going about it. I know that, you know, lots of comic creators that may be working in other mediums also have an agent, and, you know, it depends person to person, but with any kind of property, you never ever know what's going to happen with something. So I feel like it is important to have something in writing with whoever you're working with, just so everyone's on the same page, because it's really easy to say, "Oh, you know, this is great." And then, you know, 5 years down the line, or however long it is down the line.
Yeah. You've got to be upfront with your communication. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like the comic industry, the reason it's been stunted in many different ways is because people haven't been upfront with each other. And lots of both companies and creators have got into situations that didn't need to happen because a lot of it, like we've just discussed, is built on love of it, or as a hobby, or that's how it starts as a lot of people. Mm. And they don't consider these things. They don't treat it like a business. They don't treat it like those things. And then they maybe get into a situation down the line because they didn't consider those things, regardless of how humble the origins of the thing were. But that's just me. Everybody's different.
Yeah. I think it's good to just be straight with the person you're working with. And if that has to, you know, it's not rude putting it in an email to them. You know, I think, look, this is, I'm looking for this to be a one shot. I'd like this to be a 3-issue mini series. I'd like it to be 20 pages. This is kind of the style I'm going for, you know, and are you in or out? And you're saying to them what you want, don't you? You know?
Yeah.
And Beastwagon was a long job, wasn't it? When you look at it, Owen, what was Beastwagon? 5 issues. Apologies.
Yeah, it was 5 issues. I mean, our last issue was double-sized.
Right,
But, yeah, we were working on a book for 2.5 years, basically.
Yeah, that's a long job, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, we were releasing sort of an issue a quarter, because I feel like you've just got to keep that momentum going. And we're lucky that John's a real workhorse, and he was just, like, threw himself into it, considering he'd never done any comics before. But he was staggered. He was like, the amount of work you have to fucking do in this... in this medium for such little return is absolutely staggering. And I was like, yeah, that's how it works. That's what it's about. You're kind of working on something that, you know, potentially if you're working on it, you really believe in it. It can get you reputation. It can get you, you know, a really great piece of art out of it. But at the end of the day, it's never going to be something that's financially going to get you in a mansion or anything like that. And luckily he knew that kind of going in, but he's also a guy that's worked, you know, he does a load of other things. You know, he's done live painting. He does gig posters. He's a working illustrator, you know, for, you know, outside of comics. So he doesn't need comics to earn his bread and butter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
So, but
I think the whole sharing, I think what you touch on there, Owen, as well, the whole sharing the passion for a project, especially if you're collaborating with someone, is very important, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, keeping the momentum and keeping the energy up. And for something like Beastwagon, like you say, was 2.5 years, you've got to both love what you're doing around it, haven't you? You've both got to share ideas. Otherwise, you just feel like you're a man in a job at a desk, you know?
Yeah, and as you guys know, like, when it's a slow process, right? It takes a long time for this shit to happen. So... well, yes, you have to really, really love what you do. But obviously it gets to that point where it's like 3 a.m. and you're like, I fucking hate this. You know, I absolutely hate this. And everyone gets that, even if you really, really love the thing you're doing. That's not to say that it's not worth it. But, yeah, you have to really, really like what you do in order to do it. But I feel like with everyone I've worked with, it's like, I'm upfront and kind of say, you know, I haven't had any major disagreements yet, but that could always happen. But I say, you know, this isn't going to earn us much money, but I kind of want to do a book that you really, really want to do, which ties into what we were saying about writing for an artist. I don't want to have someone work on something where they're not going to get a great financial return if they're going to turn around and going to do some bullshit that are like, I hate drawing this. You have to give them the incentive to do that.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, definitely. Did you, excuse me for this, but did you work in editorial at Titan or?
No, I was entirely in marketing, which I recommend working in comics marketing for any writer, really. Really good way of working, separating basically your kind of romantic idea of what writing comics is like and the kind of the market concerns of, you know, will I make comics that will either make money? What is a publisher looking for? What sells? All of that kind of stuff. I think is really useful for writers, as long as you don't let it kind of overtake your passion and your joy for, like you said, just writing for fun. I was working in marketing. I've never in editorial.
Did you have much interaction with the writers? You know, was it something you'd have on a one-on-one basis, or would you go through? Because they don't call them editors at Titan. Excuse me, do they call them? Is it project managers or something like that? They call them, is it? Or
I still think they're editors. I could be wrong. Maybe they've mixed it up since I
right. Left. Okay.
It was always editors, and
Yeah, there's some editors that I'm still friends with, many of them, at Titan. People like Andrew James, who edits the Doctor Who stuff. There is editorial and marketing. They're kind of always working together, and there's always a push and pull to and fro there. Some of my best friends in the business are editors.
Right.
All of this talk is a nice segue into another question from Chris Thompson at Pop Culture Hound.
Who is an editor at Titan, am I right in saying?
I believe he's PR, is Chris.
PR, is he? Right, okay. Right.
Chris asked, as someone who's worked in both marketing and creative, how do you reconcile the two? How much onus is on the creators to do the legwork? I think that's quite specific to you there, Owen.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big. Well, I mean, I'm friends with Chris. Like, Chris is great. I feel like you reconcile it in kind of two ways. One is just like all knowledge is good knowledge, and like I just kind of mentioned to you, if you're putting together comics of your own, it's really just good to see how a publisher will maybe market comics, or how the whole production process on a bigger level than maybe the small press is working. It's just good to see and learn as much as you can generally in the industry that you've kind of chosen to be in. But also, I would argue you can reconcile the two by choosing the kind of comics you work on. I'm kind of lucky in that I'm in a position where all the companies I've worked for are very, very different from the kinds of comics that I make. So they're not treading on each other's toes in any big way. They're very, very separate kind of entities. And I do kind of keep them separate. I go to work and I market comics, and I love the comics that I market. And I, although I'm not working in marketing for 2000 AD, I'm a publishing assistant at this point. It's always good to see as much of that different kind of process as you can. But I feel like I then come home and, like, I write and draw books that are so very different, especially Real Love, which is kind of a semi-autobiographical kind of slice of life book with magic realism elements. That's so different from a licensed comic or, you know, Judge Dredd, that it's occupying a very, very different space.
It's certainly occupying a very personal space. I can tell that.
Yeah. Everything I do.
You need that sometimes, don't you? I think, avenue, don't you? You know.
Well, I feel like all that I can do is just do the stuff that I believe in when I'm creating my own stuff, and that just inherently means that it's going to be very, very personal to me, even if it's about animals eating, you know, members of the public. Every book I do is autobiographical in some way.
Me too.
I feel like, you've got to do that. You know, you've got to do stuff that you really, really care about, and
We can see that in people who have jobs that are nothing to do with the comics industry. You know, you can you feel sometimes that they need, especially when they're small press guys, that they need that little avenue of art to be able to escape into. You know, because you're lost without it sometimes. I do a job that isn't anything to do with comics, you know. And I just feel that sort of creative need to get out there and write stuff.
Absolutely, 100%. And I'd also argue that it's as valuable to have a job. Because they say that old thing of, if you want to work, say, in comics, or you want to work on films or whatever, make sure you've got a job, you know, a job that's earning you money as well. Yeah. And I think, well, that's one really, really good advice. But also having, you know, a job outside is giving you a perspective on things that have nothing to do with your creative stuff. And it's feeding you in a different way. There's that old thing that's like when you feel like you run out of things to write about, then just kind of go out and live. Because you can't write anything worth anything if you're not going out and doing that, you know? So as much as I say I love being working in comics, and I really do, it can get very intense because you comics 24/7, if that makes any sense. You know, I'm doing it for the day job and then I'm coming home and doing it.
Advice that people get given from writers, accomplished writers, is if you're writing for comics, don't just read comics. You got to read everything, because you're getting a filter through someone else with the comics, where if you're reading kind of real life events and other stories, and there's so much you got to try and take in that kind of flavor your work and give it a lot more life. If you're just getting comics, all you're going to write is the comics that are already out there.
It becomes a circle jerk that slowly diminishes, doesn't it?
You constantly have to be learning. Just in life, that's, you know, just because you left school doesn't mean you that's it. You know, every day you have to learn something, don't you?
Absolutely.
Regards to the marketing, say you would hire an artist and one artist was more prolific on social media by sharing their work and getting people hyped up for a product over another. Say they were both equally skilled. Would the marketing artist win out in that regard? Say they kept a high social media presence.
It certainly helps. I will say that. It depends. There's so many kind of factors. And I've also worked for kind of two very, very different companies, and I'm loath to talk too much about contract work outside of like my own creative stuff, just because whenever I work for a company, I'm under NDA. Can't go into too much. However, having said that, I think, especially with Create Your Own stuff, which ties into Chris's question as well, is that it's so great when creators that are doing their own work are really into pushing it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is like a marketing guy's dream, basically, when you've got Create Your Own stuff and you guys, or whoever's working on the book is really up for getting the word out, doing interesting things. I love both doing my own marketing and also marketing other people that it's stuff outside the box. Like, I've done a lot of like club nights. We're doing one for 2080 coming up for the first night of Thought Bubble. Doing like a thing where we'll have some live painting from 2080 artists, DJs, maybe some live bands. I love doing guerrilla kind of marketing. That's my bread and butter, is those kind of things where you know, viral. I mean, you guys have seen the Raygun website. It's nuts. Those kind of different ways of doing things are really good for comics, and thinking about different ways of talking about your work.
It's getting it out there to different people.
Exactly, absolutely.
It's
different when you've got creators that may be working on stuff that has a lot of eyes on it, like licensed properties, where maybe you're going through maybe a licensor that owns a property that is licensed out to a comic company. If you've got a creator that's then pushing stuff that maybe has embargo on it or things like that, that's where it's a little bit trickier, because it's not really in everyone's best interest when things are timed to release, which as you get more licensed properties or properties that are differently put together or managed, you can't really have a situation where, you know, things are being revealed ahead of time when that's all scheduled. But that's purely...
Okay.
You know, bigger companies have a
that
very,
must be
very
a real headache,
schedule.
I have to say. Yeah.
It is and it isn't. It's a lot of fun because a lot of the time those audiences are maybe a lot bigger than you would have on smaller creator owned projects, which is a shame sometimes.
Yeah.
But that's the nature of the beast. You know. It can become tricky, and the organization just has to be really on point, basically.
Yeah.
It's they've both got pros and cons. They're both exciting and can be tricky at the same time.
Would you say that there's now an onus on the creator to self-publicize now as well? And if he doesn't, sometimes that may be why the book doesn't sell, do you think?
Yeah, no,
I think it's a sad situation, but I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're seeing a real shift in how things are published now. There are nowhere near as enough publishers out there generally for the kind of material that's getting produced. So more and more people are self-publishing or finding new avenues. Unbound essentially is a completely new model in terms of they're fusing a traditional crowdfunder with a publisher, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about Unbound, because obviously we've heard about a million Kickstarters. I've heard about Unbound, but I don't.
No, I'm not sure about it. Yeah.
I don't know too much about it. So tell us a bit more about it, which is on there at the moment.
Absolutely. So Unbound are the world's first crowdfunding publisher. So they're basically not centrally, They basically, whereas most publishers will say, look at a Kickstarter and go, wow, that's doing really well, we'll buy that. Unbound basically is formalizing that entire process. So they're giving the power essentially over from themselves as a publisher to both the author and the reader. But there are some important caveats here in that they will let the author run both the book they want to do and the crowdfunding campaign that they want to run. So it's entirely up to that author to make sure that book gets 100% funded as a regular crowdfunder. But when the book hits 100% funded, not only will all the people that then Unbound commits to publishing that book, and then you have a situation where two print runs happen. One is for the subscribers and the people that have funded that basically get a first edition hardcover that is, the production on it is absolutely through the roof. It's a luxury item. It's a beautiful first edition.
Right.
Those people that subscribed and crowdfunded it get that, and then Unbound commits at their expense to doing a entirely new print run of your book and distributes it via the book trade, via Penguin Random House.
Okay.
So that's the real game changer in that whatever you do through Kickstarter, which I've used before and it's a great platform, Unbound, although the goals that they're putting financially may be slightly higher because they're covering some costs within their organization, are higher than maybe you do on Kickstarter. What you're, as a creator, getting with them that you're not getting anywhere else with any other crowdfunder is distribution globally.
If you hit
your targets.
Is it?
So it's more like, you've got to think of it, it's more like a marathon, yeah. Whereas Kickstarter's a sprint. You've got 30 days, you've got to hit it as soon as you possibly can, straight out the gate. Maybe in the first couple of days, you get your funding, and then everything else is gravy. That's the plan. Yeah. With this, it's more of a marathon, so it's an initial three-month period. So it goes in cycles, and you're working through three different sort of paycheck areas for different people. But really, it is you can only, you know, friends and family will only cover you for a small portion of that, and then from then on, it's forcing you to basically think of, like we discussed, readership outside of the regular maybe comics crowd. It's really hard work. These are the first comics. I'm among the first comics that have actually been picked up to be run through Unbound. So, I'm the third. So Jessica Martin, who did Elsie Harris' Picture Palace, and a couple of Vivacity, she's doing basically an autobiography of her life. Ram V, who I don't know if you guys have spoken to, he did Black Mamba through Kickstarter. It's a fantastic noir book set in Mumbai, and he's followed that up with Graffiti's Wall, which is a coming of age kind of story that's set in Mumbai, and then mine's the third. So there's only the three of us so far on that platform. So the editor, who's Lizzie Kay, who I work with at Titan, she was an editor there for a while. She is the commissioning editor because they classically, Unbound, have done books, prose novels or nonfiction books. This is their first graphic novel line, basically. So,
you sign up for it and you sort of get an editor. Do you know what I mean? It's not because Kickstarter obviously is just getting the cash and you're sorting it all out yourself, isn't it?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
So you get editorial help with Unbound through. So you're only being contacted if an editor thinks that your book will work for what they're doing. So that is far more the classic. Although Unbound are very open to pitches. So if you're at an event that we just did one at Gosh, basically, which was fantastic, and there was Lizzie, the editor, myself, and Ram. We were having a chat there, and we're talking about the whole process, start to finish. And Lizzie, who is the commissioning editor, is very open to, you can pitch things to her via email or via Twitter, or it's far more open. But she basically will pick up the books and decide, yes, we're going to run this, and run things by the people within Unbound and get sign off there. But once they've decided that you're going to do it and you've agreed that you can run the crowdfunder, then everything's left to you until you're then 100% funded. When that happens, then you know, it goes through with the regular kind of book system, and you've got, but yeah, you have an in-house editor, which again, Kickstarter doesn't have.
Interesting. Yeah, how do the rewards work with that then? Is it something that you both work on together?
Well, you have set rewards like you would on Kickstarter that you can fix, but because Unbound own their own platform, they are endlessly malleable. So if a pledge level isn't working, you can remove it, or you can come up with a new one halfway through your campaign. Or what is key as well is like it's malleable in that you can, as an author, I can talk to potential pledgers and work out what they really need, and we can tweak things so that they can get precisely what they need from it. For example, so I've been talking with cinemas and saying I can do you bespoke posters for screenings of your choice, and they say, well, yes, we can do that. Or I say, you know, is there anything you need for your cinema? I can do lobby cards. One of the pledge levels is basically to do a mural in your cinema. It's malleable, so pledgers can actually come to us with suggestions in keeping with the tone of the book, you know, and we can create original pledge levels for individuals, which is kind of unheard of as well, in that really readers and the readership are directly responsible not only for making the book happen, but also precisely what they get out of the project.
All right, okay. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's quite a new thing, is it?
Explain, because it's so...
Yeah, no, definitely.
Uncharted
territory. Yeah.
I mean, certainly if these, you know, they'll be inundated with stuff if, you know, a few of these initial projects are hugely successful.
Yeah.
It sounds really interesting, actually.
It's a grand experiment, but I also feel like it's where more and more publishers should be going in terms of the real thing that they have, which I've been saying for a while, is distribution.
Yeah.
That's the thing that, as a creator on any level, even if you're doing many projects and you're very competent at doing them through Kickstarter, of which there's loads of creators I know that are doing great stuff through Kickstarter. Yeah. I still really, really like that model, and I'll do other things through Kickstarter. I really enjoy it. But you will never get that distribution, which is, you reach a certain level of readership. You want to have a model that sustains and expands your readership.
And certainly,
I think it's
like
difficult with the. Sorry, go on, mate. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, certainly with Kickstarter, if you're doing things like you're running like a single issue Kickstarter, so you're funding issue one, issue two, there's certainly
that's what I was gonna say.
You get a drop off as it goes on, and it may not be to do it might. The quality of your comic may be ace, but I think there's certainly going to be a drop off between the first campaign and the second campaign, and that's where I find I think a few people are finding that Kickstarter is a struggle.
No, I was going to say exactly around a series. I think Kickstarter in itself, you send comics out to a certain number of people, and just by definition, 1, 2, 20, 50% of those people aren't going to like the first issue, and they're not going to buy the second. So it has to have a drop off. And you're right; you need that, you know, that model where you can sling it out to other people as well.
I kind of agree with you guys, but I mean, if it was me doing Beast Wagon again, I wouldn't do it as a series.
Right. Okay.
I would go straight to collection on that because I learned so much from doing that process, and I really enjoyed it, and I really love single issue comics.
Yeah,
there's something, and I know you guys read singles as well.
There's something to that
sequential art form, like every single time you're getting one, you know, and the serialized nature of it. I really love that. But as a small press, or for me anyway, as a independent creator, that is not a sustainable model that I can kind of finance, even through Kickstarter, to do a graphic novel and then release it, even if it takes like 5 years to pull it together. At least you know that it happens, it's there, it's done, and you're not going to have the kind of anxiety and the insecurity of whether you're going to make... Because as we all know, creator-owned comics live or die based on whether you're buying them issue to issue.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of risk to take.
Yeah,
yeah.
But you find that you even have that if you run an image book, you know, if your sales will drop off if you're doing an image book.
Yeah,
definitely. It's the nature of a beast, isn't it? It really is.
The Ryan K. Lindsay, was his bit of advice was when you're running a sequential series on Kickstarter was to not number them within the title. So right, like, actually, I think he's got like Deer Hunter, and then he would have like a subheading, and then the second book would be Deer Hunter, and then a different subheading, and in the text it would be like, this is the continuation.
Yeah.
So people wouldn't jump in and say, oh, issue two, sign off.
Especially he's if they're sufficiently standalone. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's a nice bit of thinking there.
Yeah.
So
unlike us.
Yeah, that's very true. Very rare for us. So just tell us a little bit about Real Life. Thank you very much for all that. I think we've had quite a good comic writing.
Yeah, that was good, actually. I really enjoyed that, Owen.
I have talked your ear off here about craft. Sorry.
That's fine.
That's why we got you on here.
It's nice chatting with you guys as well and seeing your opinions on stuff, because everyone makes comics different. And it's nice to just share ideas and, you know, hear what you guys have to say about stuff as well.
One day,
you know, it's like when you're in the cave, you know, you can't see the wood.
Oh dear God, yeah, we're all like Gollum. But Real Love, as it's on Unbound at the moment, for all our lovely listeners who might not know about it, just tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So it's a semi-autobiographical story about a boy that forms a relationship with his local cinema and decides he's going to follow his dreams and become a famous film director. And it's told in three parts, and each takes place over the course of a British summer. And I say it's semi-autobiographical because it's partly inspired by growing up in... It's all set in rural Cumbria, where I grew up in the Lake District. I would put it in the kind of ballpark of the films of, like, Richard Linklater, or there's a little bit of Spaced in there and a little bit of Day Tripper, in that it's kind of a bittersweet comedy, drama, with sort of magic realism elements peppered throughout.
Okay.
But it's really about movies, and it's a love letter to kind of going to the movies and having that change the way you kind of see the world, and it's about memory and the kind of art we like and stuff.
It's weird because I wrote a piece about a movie I saw when I was 12 today, weirdly, just out of complete coincidence. And I have to say, it is a real experience when you're a kid going to pictures. I mean, I saw going to pictures before we had videotapes, and if you didn't see it on a Saturday night, you'd have missed it forever. You know, and being able to go to a cinema, I think I went and saw certain movies like two or three times in a week sometimes back then. Yeah, because as a
Citizen
kid you
Kane.
Could.
Was that?
Yeah, good? Citizen Kane. Yeah, Debbie Does Dallas. What's your favourite? Is it The Mighty Ducks? Saw that a few times.
I think you find it's DT.
Hey, don't slag off The Mighty Ducks. Oh man, that movie was badass.
The flying V.
That shows our generations, Owen. Because I had Slapshot and you had The Mighty Ducks. What's going on?
No. It's different nowadays in the fact that when he's younger and you'd get taken to the cinema, so right, we're going to go see a film called The Never Ending Story. Nowadays you're forearmed with like about 50 trailers before the event. You know everything about it, you know who's in it. But then you would turn up and away you went. And again, you'd see posters in the lobby of the cinema, and it holds much promise of like all these stories to be told, and that's all you'd get from it would be the poster.
Yeah, I remember my mate at school saying to me, I was at boarding school, and he said, oh, do you know anything about Kung Fu? And I went, no, not really, as a 12-year-old. And he says, well, if you see these films, people actually die in them. And I thought, this is fucking amazing. This is blowing my mind. He said, well, let's go and see a Kung Fu film, and we'll creep in. It was a double A, which is the...
So you thought Enter the Dragon was like a snuff film for like
years? The first thing we saw was Battle Creek Brawl, which I'll talk about on it. I'll talk about it in this mailer article. And when I saw it, walking in thinking I'm going to see a movie where people die in it, I'm thinking, this is fucking amazing. But had I known like the whole story, I'd have seen four trailers now, wouldn't I? I'd know the whole movie, but like fucking blew my mind as a kid. Amazing stuff. Your first movie was it Star Wars in Real Love One, isn't it?
I fudged things, really.
You're right. Okay.
I wasn't old enough to see Star Wars.
Well, we wondered if it
around.
Was the re-release. You know the.
Yeah,
you...
it was. Yeah, yeah.
Right, I get you. Yeah. Okay.
So all the shitty bits I saw and was no, but to be fair, to really really own this, I had seen Star Wars a shitload on VHS.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So before those re-releases happened, but. It's such a, like, this is what I'm saying is why it's semi-autobiographical, and I'm sure you guys will get this, is that you're tweaking certain stuff just because it would purely make a better story. And
it could be speculative.
For so many people, you know, Star Wars was such a big bang, and it was for me, but you kind of, what's more story shaped is maybe different from maybe the truth. But the first movie I actually remember watching, which is in the first chapter of Real Love, is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, the Costner.
It all makes sense now.
And the witch in that, well, I always forget who it's played by. I'm aware in hindsight is not terrifying at all, but absolutely made me chaff my pants, and I had to be removed because I was just so terrified by this witch. And in hindsight, it's not a scary scene at all. But I found that that links up with a lot of people in the, you know, it's the fire and the thunder of the cinema and the loudness of it. And it's quite a overwhelming experience when you're very, very young.
There's no hiding place at all.
No.
You're kind of like, you're getting hit by this imagery and sounds. There's no kind of settee to hide behind.
It's pretty potent,
Yeah, I went and saw Star Wars. My dad took me, and we saw it in Leicester Square. And back then you could drive through Leicester Square. There was a road going through, so you could actually almost sort of drive through and park. I remember we parked about two roads away because you could do that back then, you know. And I remember being outside, and there was, used to have to queue up outside picture houses back then. I remember queuing up outside, and there was a midget and another guy doing like busking, you know.
Yeah.
And we went in and saw Star Wars, and on the way out, my dad went, "You see that bloke who was busking outside earlier?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, he was probably the bloke in that robot." I thought, "That's fucking amazing."
Yeah.
I've just seen R2-D2.
You were so easily convinced of everything. And then
later, a certain DC artist told me that he'd seen Kenny Baker's Cock and Balls later on. So I can't reveal who it is.
Well,
it's quite good.
My aunt took me and my brother to see Jedi in Leicester Square when first came out. Got taken on the number 68 bus.
Yeah.
And both of us being absolutely terrified of Jabba. The witch out of Robin Hood. Like, you look at it now.
That was your.
Because Jabba's oh my God.
what was the first movie you can remember seeing in the pictures? It was Prince of Thieves for you, was it? I mean, or.
Yeah, that's the one I remember. I'm sure that's not true, but as I say, most of this is all about memory and stuff like that. But that was the first one I actually remember seeing.
What about you two guys?
Oddly enough, Memphis Belle. Do you know that film?
Oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
An intellectual, aren't you?
Yeah, but shortly afterwards, I saw the film Dennis. You know, the American Dennis.
Oh,
fucking hell.
Dennis.
Yeah.
I like to balance it out.
Yeah. That explains your life to me now. I completely understand you.
They just released Memphis Belle on Netflix. I don't know if you guys saw that.
I've seen that film so many times.
Released loads of them because... they just did you may have seen it, a documentary called Five Came Back, which is about all the filmmakers that went and filmed, were involved in the war, in World War II. If you guys check, it's really fucking amazing documentary. And they get Spielberg and Francis Ford Coppola in it and loads of other guys talking about it, but it talks all about those movies that were made over in the war. It's amazing, yeah.
Have you, have you seen Red Tails? That was on Netflix.
I have not. No.
Oh, it's garbage. It's really bad.
It looked a bit CGI.
CGI. You know, you see those documentaries like on the Discovery Channel and they recreate like air battles or battles with like really poor CGI. It's like one step above that. It's really poor.
Oh, God.
And kind
what
of
about it, you, Dan?
Oh, for me, one of the earliest ones I can remember going to was E.T.
Oh, okay.
That was back in the day when, like, basically the merchandise was everywhere. You'd have cereal boxes.
But did the beginning?
Everything.
Did the beginning scare you? Because the beginning of that film is pretty terrifying when you're a little kid.
Different scary moments. It was weird. As a young age, I can remember crying through most of the film, and then like several days later, reflecting on the fact that I felt like I'd been manipulated.
Yeah. Is it because like E.T. essentially looks like an old man's bollock with a face?
Again, this is explaining.
And it glows.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember seeing that movie. My sister, I've got a sister who's a couple of years younger than me, going, that's going to be more popular than Star Wars. And I said, shut up. I was like, shut up, you idiot. No, it's not going to be. And then I think it was for a while, wasn't it? I think it overtook it in the money stakes. Yeah. For me, it was Journey to the Center of the Earth's Core with Doug McClure.
Oh, brilliant. I fucking love those films.
Yeah.
Just classic adventuring.
Yeah. You can't beat Doug McClure, can you, either?
Yeah.
And there's always some young lady who happens to be human.
Yeah. And sexy.
Yeah. About 30 years the dude's junior.
I think cinema experiences are sometimes a lost art these days.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I cherish going to the cinema
because they're so expensive. You've really got to like a film to fucking see it these days.
Yeah,
that's it. I put Goonies on Netflix the other day for my son, and he's 7, and I had to turn it off.
Why?
I've seen Goonies a couple times recently when it's been on TV, and I didn't realise that they've been cut. And when you watch it on Netflix, the uncut version, it's like Jesus Christ. There's like. S-bombs going off all the time, F-bombs going off all the time. There's reference to drugs, sex, violence.
Oh, God. Look, we all need that
as
a grown.
It's pretty hardcore stuff.
It's kind of like, Jesus Christ, I didn't think it was this heavy.
Right, so, I mean, obviously, we've all got great memories of the cinema and stuff, and Real Love is a massive example of that. So, for all our listeners out there, if they want to find out more about it, where can they go to find out more about Real Love?
Sure. It's currently crowdfunding on Unbound. So the web address for the book is unbound.com/books/real-love. Nice. But yeah, I can send the link so you can include it.
It'll be in the show notes. Yeah.
And that page
has artwork and stuff on there.
Page has got a little video. It's got artwork and it's also got all the pledge levels. So you can kind of see what takes your fancy on there.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, mate, I have to say. Yeah. Yeah, really good stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We might have to have you back on to have an actual movie conversation, because the danger with movie conversations is I could have them all night. So.
I find I'm often out in either a pub or a cafe and with a mixed group of friends, and we'll start talking, and you'll get onto movies, and some people will be right there with you, and then you'll always lose like a third of the audience and their eyes will glaze over. I kind of cherish that moment when, you know, you're talking about, how there was a sheet of glass in front of the Cobra when they were shooting Raiders of the Lost Ark, so Harrison Ford wouldn't get bitten. And you can just feel that they're kind of like, oh, God, this is a real nerd.
Who needs those people?
But always happy to talk movies. Always love doing it.
Speaking of
comic script writing, you working for 2000 AD, you've actually got a script writing book came out last year, I think, is that right, Owen?
Yes, that sells really well. It's basically
really good.
Top writers and artists talking about the process, and you know, it's a really good way of seeing how different writers tackle different scripts.
Awesome.
So all of that goodness will be in the show notes, as well as our recommendations, which are coming up. But before that, do we have any shout-outs, gents?
Yeah, I've got a couple. Emily, is Emily's middle name Brian? Because it's B, isn't it? I never know what it is. Emily Owens got a Kickstarter out.
Is it Baracus?
Yeah. Brain Shoodles, which is going gangbusters on Kickstarter and is well worth a punt, but is also well past its figure. Have a look at it. Brain Shoodles, Shoodles. Also been asked to pimp by Gareth. Gareth Brooks contacted me and mentioned the South London Comic and Zine Fair, which is the 15th of July at the Stanley Halls in South Norwood, an area we both know well, Dan, don't we?
Yes, I do.
If you go to @SLCZF for the details, you can find that. And finally, one that Laura Trinder contacted us, asked me if I could give a shout out to. That's the 12th of August. Is A Geeky Mind, and it's a charity mini convention for Mind, the charity Mind, and it's awesome. Handsome Hall, Wellington Street, Leicester, LE1-6HL on the 12th of August between 10 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. Looks like a really great lineup. So head on that one.
Is that there Handsome Hall, as in like attractive, handsome?
H-A-N-S-O-M, I think it's spelt.
I thought it was Dan's house. Never mind.
Yeah. Oh, that picture someone found on the web this week may have been the greatest picture ever. Why is that not your Twitter profile now?
Yeah, I should amend that. I should change that.
Anyone not know what we're talking about, go to the chat page. Somebody found a picture of a man pretty much naked.
It was off of a hen do. Was it?
Oh, was that what it's from? Like a drawing of a man, and it looks exactly like you. I can testify.
Any other shout-outs?
That's it for me.
Splendid. So now it's that time of the week where we're going to recommend a whole load of cool shit for you to check out in the next week. So who wants to go first?
I'll go in first.
Ooh.
I don't mind. Yeah. Come on, Butcher. There's a comic sent in to us called The Axeman Cometh. It's written by Daryl Smith, art by PXD, led by a friend of the show, Rob Jones, and coloured by Saad Azim. It was a book. The comic was kickstarted at the end of 2016, and obviously since I've read a copy, it hit its target, and it's now in publication. I think it's just kind of in the process of getting out to backers. You can get it in the UK through Infinity and Beyond. It's a comic shop in Shrewsbury, but they do an online ordering service, so if you want to get through them, yeah, go for it. I do have the American one, which is The Outer Limits in the US, which I don't have any details of. But it's one of those things that once it kind of hits the backers, it will start going online and I can pass those details on. It's essentially it's a 28-page like Southern Gothic crime noir comic set in the 1920s. And the main character, Robert Flint, is a private detective. And he's kind of a bit down on his lack of cases, and he takes on a new case from a young lady down in New Orleans called Virginia Westmeyer. And basically the story follows as Flint and his kind of office partner go down to New Orleans and start trying to tackle where this kind of serial killer who's murdered this woman's family is going to strike next. There's a considerable twist in the tale that I can't really discuss, but it's very well done. Apparently the story is inspired by three unsolved murder cases that were in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, and they've sort of all been kind of like mashed up for this, the purposes of the story. It's very, the book tries to and achieves a very Hitchcock feel in both the kind of the writing style and the art. It does it very well. I mean, the art is very good on the period piece. It's one of those reasons I'd be reticent to try doing a period comic, because it makes or breaks on those little bits of detail in the artwork. It's got you have to do so much work. There's like a one-page splash of a train going across the states, and it feels almost like a photo. It's really well done. Very nice, all the kind of like detailing's there. There's sometimes there's not a lot of detailing, but there's just enough. There's that kind of fine balance of there's enough detail to sell the panel and tell you where you are in the world of the story. As I said before, early on the podcast, like Rob does the lettering and he kind of sticks with the themes of the book, and it kind of does really well. The one thing I'd kind of mention on this, the colouring in the comic, it changes palettes a few times through the story. And that's usually when it goes to flashbacks, it'd be like in a kind of a muted tone of black and white with very kind of subtle colouring. And other times it goes kind of a bit more lurid. I feel that when it kind of goes into the more lurid, overly saturated, it kind of comes out of the story a little bit, because when you're looking back and you think, right, this is the period piece and the colors are quite muted, it kind of fits with the time period. But when it gets like very bright backgrounds of blue or pink or yellow, it jars a little, because you don't expect to see that kind of color like then. And it's just like a straight scene. So I would say some of the color choices are a bit unsure on. When there's other moments in the comic when the colorist has done such an excellent job, that's the only kind of negativity I'd mention about the title.
Okay.
But it's an excellent comic. I'm not sure if there's going to be a follow-up issue because it's not one of, it's just the comic on its own. It yeah. is a kind of self-encapsulated comic on its own, but it does allude to further tales potentially coming down the line. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
No, interesting.
Awesome.
Cool.
So where can you get that from?
So you can get it in the UK in a place called Infinity and Beyond. We'll stick that in the show notes.
Nice.
I'm sure they'll be able to send a copy out. And when it goes digital, which should be, I think Daryl said it should be going on digital in July. So when that goes up, I'll give a shout out on the podcast.
Lovely.
Nice one.
Do you want to go next time?
Okay, mate, yeah. What? Let me pose you a question as the introduction to my little recommend. What are the three things, you should know this, Owen, what are the three things that 2000 AD has taught us?
Three things?
Yeah.
I don't know, where are you going with this?
Shall I give you a clue? They are to be pure, to be vigilant, and to behave. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm going to talk about... that, and it's the 2018 Judge Dredd The Secret History by Pat Mills that came out mere days ago as a book. It's currently a digital book. You'll soon be able to get it as a printed copy, and there is a rumour going around that Pat might be doing a audio book of it, which would be fucking brilliant.
That'd be fucking ace, yeah.
Yeah, anyone who's seen his performances on stage on the podcast or seen him on the 2018 documentary, it was a masterclass in passion, wasn't it? Let's face it. What the book does, it reaches back well beyond 2000 AD, and it details the comics landscape in the 1970s and how, in both London and in Dundee, which is where Pat and John Wagner had a shed that they famously worked in and would have a tear up every so often in this shed and would type on paper and probably smoke a lot. It reaches from there all the way into London to battle and then action through 2000 AD onto Misty, Toxic and Crisis, and it details the history of the creation of all those comics, but most especially through the creation of 2000 AD, which on page one Pat so brilliantly sums up as through a minefield of imbeciles and chimps is how it sort of came to be birthed. Have you had a chance to read it yet, Owen?
No, I haven't, I'm afraid. No, it won't slip me by.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant, and it originally came out as a series of blog posts that Pat made a good couple of years ago that he has taken and elaborated hugely on. I mean, they are quite a small part of the book, but they form a sort of a certain framework to it. And it details, like I said, through action. You know, we all know that moment when, has anyone seen the moment on Nationwide where Frank Boff rips up a copy of Action Comic?
No, I haven't seen that.
Weekly, yeah. And you knew, I mean, Frank let himself down later on in life, didn't he? When he got discovered, was he tied to a wall in a mask, I think, maybe at a party? You know, so good old Frank and Nesta, they had their dark side as well. But you realised when that happened, you sort of got the sense that there was a change coming in comics. And that change would eventually be 2000 AD, which we all love. And you know, and I know you're responsible, Wayne, for organising the 40th convention. It was absolutely brilliantly attended.
It was a great show. It was fun.
Yeah. Oh, great, mate. Yeah, we had an absolute blast, didn't we, guys? You know.
Yeah.
And what Pat does is he goes through specifically all of the earlier characters. He goes through Dredd most especially, and you see the creation from something that I won't spoil the book because it needs to be read. But you know, from something that was completely different. Based on a hangman, you know, a hanging judge from years ago, and he nicked the name from a reggae band, through to what we eventually do see, and the hands that it went through until it turned out into this, you know, sort of well crafted, almost from prog too, you know, Dredd was this incredibly well sort of thought out and prepared character, and Pat lays great pavements in the road in relation to creating characters. He says you need that time to create and think about something so it works. And he talked through loads of characters that, you know, like Mac One, Meltdown Man, Slane, ABC Warriors, you know, all of the great, great characters, Strontium Dog, that appeared. But what he does is he does it in a way that, I mean, we talk a lot about it, and we were talking about before we came on air about, you know, and we touched on it during the show about how comics need to survive, don't they? We need to learn from our mistakes. And I think if there's anyone we should be listening to, certainly in the UK, it's Pat and the people who grew up and came up with Pat around 2000 AD and all the other comics. You know, Crisis is one of my favourite things ever. I think it was an absolutely brilliant idea, intelligently done comics. And I think if you read this book, it does, it's both an artifact in relation to the history of stuff like Paddy McGinty's goat as a story, you know, and the fact that Wagner at one point decided he didn't want to do Judge Dredd because he looked like a Spanish pirate, you know, this sort of thing, just like really funny, really interesting anecdotes. He talks about creators Doug Church, Jerry Finley Day, Tony Skinner, Leo Baxendale, Simon Bisley, Neil Gaiman, Jenny McDade, Alan Moore, Matt Smith, and on and on and on. And he champions the work of creators, you know, and champions this comic, which he started and he still loves so much. You know, you can, it just comes across. My favourite bit in it is his conversation about Nemesis the Warlock. And there's a phrase in it where he says, Nemesis the Warlock was my catharsis and it was my poetry. And at that moment, you realise how much Bat has invested in this title over the years. Just glorious, glorious stuff. He talks about 2000 AD being his first experience of fandom and how comics changed from having a general sort of market of, you know, Joe Public, you know, they buy a comic and enjoy it and read it, you know, through to being the property, possibly, I'm going to describe it as the property of fandom. I think comics, we shifted at some point, whether it was when direct market began, you know, it became the property of people who considered themselves to be comic fans, just rather than people who read a comic on the bus. You know, he talks a lot about that. A really interesting point of view around it. As I say, it's currently, if you go to Amazon, you can buy a digital copy. If you follow Pat at Pat Mills Comics, or if you pop over to www.millsverse.com, you can have a look at it. A big shout out to Lisa Mills, who did all the editing on it, at FeistyCuffs71. Lisa and Pat are both, they're like a cottage industry. Talk about self-publishing. Those two, you know, no mucking about. Got a great book out. There's another one coming soon. You know, great stuff. Really interesting. And I read it in a day, and I've returned to it three or four times since. Yeah, very good. Highly awesome. Recommended.
You there can't you say fairer than that.
There you go.
See, we're not we're not just about the comics on here. There's prose as well.
So, yeah, there you go. Yeah. Look at us.
We're cultured on here.
We didn't see Memphis Belle, our first film.
Then Dennis. Now, the book I'm going to recommend this week is from a publisher called Aftershock Comics. Have you heard of them?
Yes. Yeah.
They've done I've seen them about. This is the first book I've got of theirs, so, and it's called Baby Teeth.
Oh, okay.
Now, it's written by Donnie Cates. And,
I like his stuff, yeah.
Art by Gary Brown. I believe Donnie Cates wrote God Country, is that the one of the
Yes, ones? He does, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
I've heard a lot of good things about that. Yeah, he writes this with art by Gary Brown. Those two are also the creators of this book. Mark Engler is the colourist. Taylor Esposito is the letterer. I've heard his name quite a few times in the past.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And basically the story is this. Sadie Ritter is 16 years old, 9 months pregnant, and scared out of her sweet, nerdy mind. Having a baby that young is tough, but with the support of her loving family behind her, everything should be okay. Oh yeah, and also her baby is the Antichrist, and it's going to break open the barriers between the earthly and demonic planes and unleash eternal suffering to all of humankind. Other than that, though, she should be fine. So basically, that's your setup in a nutshell. It's a book about the Antichrist. Hey! Now, I was immediately taken by this book from the cover alone, which was... It's a hand holding one of those pregnancy tests, but instead of the blue line, there's a pentagram on it. Immediately, the design got me. I'm a sucker. I mean, it's one thing to have a good cover, but of course the interiors have to be up to scratch, and this one thankfully does have as well. I mean, even the font on the T of baby teeth is an upside down cross, which I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff as well. The issue one's very much a setup issue, but in the best kind of sense. It starts with the protagonist, Sadie. She sits down to record a message for her son. And that, in turn, acts as the narration for the issue.
Right.
Which, that aspect works really well, I think. Sometimes it can be overdone. But it's nice sense of mystery because it's almost like a flashback, isn't it? You know when you have those scenes and it starts and you have 3 weeks earlier, and sometimes that's a really cheap storytelling gimmick. But in this, it works really well. Because you want an idea of who's who in an issue. And I think her narration over the top of it helps you find out more about that. And just the storytelling is brilliant, I think. Because it feels very natural. It's all dialogue sort of narration. It all sort of makes sense. I was really impressed with it, actually. The characters are great. I mean, the first issues of very important, like having to get across who's in it and getting you attached to people. And this actually does it really brilliantly. There's wonderful touches of humour to help with that as well. There's a particular two-panel scene of an idiot getting a cigarette flicked in his face, which was a highlight for me, especially in the guided narrative view of Comixology. Because you really have that sort of moment. It happens. You know those scenes where it almost looks... It's almost a copy of one another, isn't it? But you just see the
action. Yeah.
It just works really, really well. But yeah, you have Sadie and you have her sister who's a bit of a badass and doesn't mess around. And then you have her father who seems to be a bit of a pilot. He seems like a good man. So it seems like there's a really nice group of characters that you need to get behind. And it doesn't really tell you too much in terms of like who the father is, you know, what's going on. But it's pretty dark, I would say. When you deal with things like the Antichrist, that's usually quite dark, isn't it? But this story isn't steeped in shadows and sort of grimness. Well, not yet. Which is a nice touch, because there's no sort of like, you know, dark cults waiting in the shadows. You know, none of that sort of The Omen type nonsense, which I thought was quite refreshing, because I thought this sort of story would go down that angle. The art itself is awesome, really fitting to the story. There's great kinetic energy, because the first issue basically starts off, she goes into labor and she's being rushed to the hospital and suffering contractions. Now when she has these contractions, everything on the page, it almost feels to shake. You know it seems like everything's like going crazy, and you feel this intense power that she's feeling. I'm not quite sure if the rest of the world is feeling it at the same time, because I think there's minor sort of earthquakes and tremors, because this is the Antichrist being born after all. But the colour palette by Engler is absolutely spot on as well, because you'll have a normal sort of watercoloured sort of page, but then when she has a contraction, there's real sharp contrasts in colours, like oranges and reds. You know, you can feel the pain that's happening. Really good. It really emphasises and enhances the scenes. And the book builds up to a nice cliffhanger ending, which left me wanting to know more. There's a wonderful scene once the baby's born. I'm not going to spoil it, but she names the child. And
Vincent.
No, although you could call the Antichrist that, couldn't you?
I don't think so.
No. The name that she gives him, there's a nice sort of in-joke that's told in the narration as well, which I won't spoil for anyone here, because I chuckled out loud at it. So I'm on for the ride with this one.
I met that Donny Coates that he did in the New York Comic Con. I covered and photographed a Star Trek signing he did with Lambeau, and he is a really nice guy.
Awesome.
Yeah, top bloke.
Yeah, really, really nice. It's some of the best sort of horror stories or stories set in that sort of realm. It's always built on character. And this is a character book, so I'm looking forward to seeing more. It was actually £2.49 on Comixology, which is on the higher end of my digital book purchases per week, because normally a lot of indie books are a bit cheaper, or you know, $1.99.
The newer books tend to be that though, don't they?
This one was well worth it, and plus you get back matter as well. We were talking about layouts and script. You have process pages. It shows you the script, it shows you the layouts, it shows you the inks, it shows you the colours and then the letters. So it shows you how an entire comic page comes to fruition, which is really nice. Plus it also has a preview of another book by Cullen Bunn and Mirko Kolak called Unholy Grail. You get more than your money's worth. So yeah.
Yes.
Nice. So cool. Definitely recommend Baby Teeth, which you can find probably on your bookstores, your bookshelves, in your local comic book store, or Comixology. Get it there. It's great. I'm going to be following it. I love it. There you go.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Right, there's ours. Owen, do you have a recommendation for our lovely listeners?
I would definitely recommend people check out some of the other graphic novels that are my Unbounders stable mates. So Graffiti's Wall by Ram V. And Jessica Martin's book, which is up there. There may be some more at the time this goes live, I'm not sure, but I definitely check those out and just check out Unbound generally and the graphic novels that are up there.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to. Yeah, I've actually written a note here to look it up. Yeah, interesting stuff.
Yeah,
And the we talked about him earlier, but Mark Penman, for my money, is just doing some really great stuff. He's I don't know whether it's quite finished yet, but he has his second big Emurian tale closing out now. It's called The Shattered. It's very, very good. The first one, if people haven't checked out, which they definitely should, is called The Waterbringer, and I kind of like to describe it as Kurosawa meets H.P. Lovecraft. So people should just definitely check that out. And another really great artist that I really love is doing really good things in webcomics right now is James Lawrence, who's doing The Legend of La Mariposa, which is a female-led adventure luchador wrestling comic, which is absolutely fantastic and deserves all the readers. So they're the two, just off the top of my head, that are just great buds that are doing really good comics.
Which is it's a wonderful segue, actually, because that character is taking part in the awesome comics podcast, Jam Piece.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, sweet.
Which is coming along nicely. It's going to be a print which we're going to launch at London Super Comic Con, and it's basically a poster just filled with some of the best small press characters out there, and they all look really great together. So
yeah,
thank
it's
you very
getting
much.
Jammed back now, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. And there's still space for more, so keep sending them in.
Yeah.
I'm going to be adding a couple of my own this coming week. But you can send
I've got
them...
a speed cock for it.
Oh God. God, I'll probably get sent that as well over the next couple of days. Remember, it's got to be a .png, Tony.
Exactly.
So, if you've got a character that you want to supply to it, you can send it to tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. There'll be more work in progress that you'll probably see over the next week, and just see how crazy busy it's getting. It's amazing. I love it.
Yeah.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Thank you very much again, Owen, for joining us.
Yeah, cheers, Owen.
Thank you so much, guys. Really enjoyed it.
We love the process shows. They could go on for hours, but unfortunately, this one isn't going to.
It's been a few hours already, let's face it.
Yeah. We've given you enough people. And we
I need my tea.
We hope you all enjoyed it. You can. There's several different ways you can get in touch with us. You can email us, awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, @theawesomepod. Like us on Facebook. Go on. facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast, and do what all the cool kids are doing this year. Join the Facebook group Awesome Comics Talk. It's actually the only decent place on Facebook, let's be honest.
It's true.
Yeah. And it's great, and there's book clubs, there's process talk, there's creators meeting each other in a non-sexy way.
Very sexy,
right? Well, partly sexy. Yeah. It gets sexier whenever any of us jump on.
Yeah,
that was the worst.
Right up.
That was the worst phrasing I could have used.
But yeah,
it's been a long weekend.
Now.
And thank you for listening to us, whether it was on the website awesomecomics.podbean.com. Now, if you listen to us there, if you listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, the Podnose Network, wherever you listen to us, send us a lovely review, and it helps get the word out about the show. And that's what small press needs. You just need to spread the word. Like Lurpak.
Like it, share it.
Yeah. There you go.
Chlamydia.
Oh, God. Always ends with that, doesn't it? where can people find us online, etc.? Tony?
Well, I've got to give a bit of a shout-out. Me and Nick, we're doing so much extra work because we're having a lot of fun doing Cockney Kung Fu.
Are you moving in together? Are you getting
married? Yeah, we're thinking of moving in-house together, yeah.
Lovely.
For the strip we're doing for the anthology, Cockney Kung Fu, we've done loads of extra stuff. So we've decided to do a mail-out. So if you go to tinyletter.com/CockneyKungFu, we're sending out some of the art process, some extra art that Nick's doing. I've done a couple of essays. There's one gone out about a movie I saw that sort of influences one of the characters. A few recommends, and even we're doing a little playlist of music to listen to whilst reading the comic. So go and sign up for it, tinyletter.com/CockneyKungFu, and it goes out Wednesday. Otherwise, I'm going to be at LCAF, definitely Friday and Saturday this weekend, possibly Sunday, depending on work. And it's 16th to 18th. It's the Round Chapel, 1 Glenarm Road, E5, 0LY in East London. Pop down. It's going to be really good. The lineup's going to be great again. A lot of people we know and whose work we loved on the show is going to be there. I really look forward to this convention every year. So there you go.
Awesome.
Nice.
Cool.
Dan, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at VanguardComic.com.
Which you should. He's banging it out.
Properly. Yeah, really good this week, dude.
Thank
really
you. Nice.
Yeah.
You can find me on Twitter at Jester Diablo, and you can find out more about my comics, etc., at theredmaskfrommars.com. And Owen, you gent, where can people find you, etc.?
You can find me online on Twitter at Owen_Johnson, and the website for my comics generally is changelingstudios.com, and the Unbound website, which is unbound.com/books/real-love.
Cool.
There you go.
Definitely.
Plenty of real love in this show, and it's time to, time to shut.
Have you got an exhibition at Orbital still as well? Sorry to interrupt.
Yes. Yeah. That's up till the end of the month. So if you want to check that out, that's all original artwork for chapters 1 and 2 of Real Love in the Flesh. Until the end of June.
Cool.
So there you go. Yeah. You've got no excuse. Get some Michael Johnson in your life.
So you're just going to stop and get some Owen Michael Johnson in you.
Do it.
You can do that too if you like. We're not going to judge you.
We've had 2 hours of him being in us, so now it's over to you. Thank you very much for listening, folks. As always have a brilliant week. Read lots of small press comics, spread the love, and as always, just stay awesome. See ya.
See ya.
See ya later. Bye-bye.